Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The magnitude of hostilities between Israel and Hamas and the scope of death and destruction in Gaza have been unprecedented and unbearable to witness.
Israel's killed at least 46 Palestinians in the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza. But hope is growing for a new ceasefire. The head of Hamas's political wing is in Egypt for talks as the UN Security Council prepares to vote on a new Gaza resolution. We'll speak to Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi, author of The Hundred Years' War on Palestine. Then we look at how a group of Palestinian Christians are trapped in the Holy Family Church in Gaza, where a mother and daughter, parishioners, were just shot dead this weekend by an Israeli sniper.
The people in this church, Mr. Speaker, are civilians. They have nothing to do with Hamas. They are nuns, orphans, disabled people. They are a small Christian community, and they know everyone. As the Pope has said, and my family can confirm, it is categorically untrue to say Hamas are operating from there.
And then to Texas, where Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed one of the nation's most extreme anti-immigrant bills, empowering local police to arrest anyone they suspect of entering the United States without authorization. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh is in Egypt to discuss a possible new truce. The Wall Street Journal reports Hamas is also in discussion with Palestinian rivals Fatah about a possible joint scenario for ruling Gaza and the West Bank after the war. On Tuesday, Israeli President Isaac Herzog said the country is open to a new temporary truce to secure the release of more hostages. For now, Israel's bloody assault continues with a major attack reported just as we went to broadcast on Rafah near the Kuwaiti hospital. On Tuesday, more strikes in Rafah killed at least 20 people. A Palestinian woman lost her two grandchildren in the attack.
At 2:30 in the morning, we woke up as the house was falling on our heads. I did not wake up when the young men came to pull us out of the rubble. I have two grandchildren who were martyred. Princess Aisha is 2 weeks old. Her name was not recorded in the texts. She does not have a birth certificate, meaning her identity has been unknown since the day she was born. She does not have it, a birth certificate, and her brother was 2 years old.
Elsewhere, the health ministry says dozens were killed in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Many others remain trapped under the rubble of destroyed buildings. The Foreign Press Association in Jerusalem filed a petition with the Israeli Supreme Court to request immediate access for foreign media to enter the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military has restricted much of the territory to foreign outlets and required journalists embed with its forces and receive Israeli approval on their reporting. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 68 media workers have been killed since October 7th. Meanwhile, a UN Security Council vote on a Gaza resolution that would push to halt fighting was postponed for a second time and rescheduled for today. The delay comes amidst reported disagreements within the Biden administration, which has been blocking or trying to water down any UN statements. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announced a 10-nation coalition to protect trading interests in the Red Sea after a series of attacks by Yemen's Houthi rebels. The coalition includes Bahrain, Canada, France, Italy, the U.K., and the Seychelles. Houthi officials have said their drone and missile attacks would continue as long as Gaza suffers from Israel's unrelenting assault. In Washington, D.C., dozens of protesters were arrested inside the U.S. Capitol Tuesday in a peaceful action demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and an end to U.S. military aid to Israel. Over 80 organizers made up of a coalition of Jewish, Muslim, Palestinian labor, racial justice and immigrant rights leaders gathered in the Capitol Rotunda chanting and holding white banners, including one that read, "The people choose life. Ceasefire now." Among those arrested at Tuesday's rally is Palestinian-American community organizer Linda Sarsour. In a historic decision, the Colorado Supreme Court ruled Donald Trump does not qualify for the state's 2024 presidential primary ballot, citing his role in the January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. In a 4-3 ruling, the Colorado justices found Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution applies to Trump, reversing a lower court's decision. Last month, the judge agreed that Trump had engaged in an insurrection, but said presidents are not subject to the Constitution's insurrection clause, which was originally designed to prevent Civil War Confederates from returning to government. Trump has vowed to appeal as he used the news to launch a fresh fundraising request. The case could end up at the U.S. Supreme Court and set a major precedent for all other states. In related news, a judge has ordered Pennsylvania Congressmember Scott Perry to turn over some 1,700 cell phone records as part of the federal January 6 probe. The Senate on Tuesday confirmed nearly a dozen nominations for senior military positions, putting an end to Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville's blockade of Pentagon promotions. Tuberville had unsuccessfully sought to force a change on the military's policy of paying for abortion-related travel for employees. The Senate, however, decided it will not vote on a new funding package for Ukraine until next year. Congress has stalled on the issue in part over Republican demands any aid be tied to harsh new immigration restrictions. New air attacks hit Kyiv and other regions of Ukraine overnight, though no casualties were reported. Meanwhile, the UN Tuesday condemned Russian violations of international law and war crimes in occupied areas of Ukraine, including 142 documented cases of civilian executions. This is UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk.
On occupied territory, we have documented widespread torture and ill-treatment of detainees, including sexual violence, as well as large numbers of forced disappearances. In addition, there has been extensive failure by the Russian Federation to take adequate measures to protect civilians and protected civilian objects against the effects of their attacks.
Sudan's rapid support forces have seized control of Wad Madani, the nation's second-largest city, which was once a refuge for hundreds of thousands of people escaping violence in the capital, Khartoum. Thousands have fled their homes on buses and on foot as fighting between the Sudanese army and the RSF intensified in Wad Madani. The RSF's takeover of the city has marked a new turn in Sudan's eight-month conflict that broke out in April. The UN's warned hunger in Sudan's conflict zones is headed toward famine-like conditions, while nearly 7 million people have been internally displaced or forced to flee Sudan. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, nationwide polls for president and local leaders have opened after a three-hour delay. In eastern DRC, voters and observers complained of poorly organized election sites and missing names from voting rolls.
There were quite a few people who didn't end up on the list. We, the observers, can see that the organization was not good in this respect. People are wondering how they're going to vote if they can't find their way around. Yet they also have the right to do their duty to vote.
Ongoing violence in the war-torn east of the DRC has displaced millions and prevented an estimated 1.5 million people from registering to vote. Incumbent President Felix Tshisekedi is seeking a second five-year term, is running in a packed field of nearly 20 hopefuls. Other candidates include Moise Katumbi, a former governor and mining magnate, former oil executive Martin Fayulu, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Denis Mukwege. Mukwege's Panzi Hospital has treated tens of thousands of survivors of sexual violence from armed groups. The DRC is home to massive reserves of natural resources, including cobalt, which is used to make lithium batteries for cell phones and other electronic devices. Lithium is considered essential amidst the transition away from fossil fuels, but Congolese people have not benefited from the prize mineral. Insecurity, poverty, corruption, and the management of resources are key issues in the election. In related news, the UN Security Council voted unanimously Tuesday to gradually phase out its 14,000 peacekeeping troops in the DRC. Congolese authorities and local communities have called for their withdrawal, saying the international force failed to prevent escalating violence. Bolivia has signed a multi-million-dollar deal with a Russian firm to build a pilot lithium plant that would produce parts for electric vehicles. This is Bolivian President Luis Arce.
We want our Bolivian lithium company, Bolivian Lithium Deposits, YLB, to compete with foreign technology and companies that have come to Bolivia to work with our lithium. We want that competition because we are the world's top lithium reserve.
Bolivia has the largest lithium deposits in the world, drawing interest from foreign powers. Earlier this year, Bolivia's state company, YLB, also signed an agreement with China. But many have opposed lithium exploitation over fears it could lead to the displacement and impoverishment of indigenous communities in the Andes. Environmentalists have also warned lithium extraction places massive demands on fresh water supplies. Back in the United States, New York Governor Kathy Hochul signed a bill creating a commission to consider reparations for Black New Yorkers who've endured the ongoing legacy of slavery and racism. It's the third state to launch such a task force after California and Illinois. Among other things, the commission will investigate housing discrimination, policing and incarceration, and income inequality. A recent report by the New York City Comptroller's Office found white households in the state have a median net worth almost 15 times higher than Black households. The commission could recommend monetary or other forms of compensation through New York would not be compelled, though New York would not be compelled to abide by these. Reverend Al Sharpton spoke at Tuesday's signing ceremony.
I do not know where the commission will go, but I know that history is made because there is a commission and there is a recognition. And sometimes, even if you can't take away the pain and the scar, we gain a lot by being recognized that is due to be repaired.
And in Germany, acclaimed Russian-American writer Masha Gessen received the prestigious Hannah Arendt Prize on Saturday in an extremely scaled-down ceremony. The event was supposed to take place last week in Bremen City Hall, but award sponsors and the city of Bremen withdrew after Gessen compared Gaza to the Warsaw Ghetto in a recent New Yorker article. Gessen, who is Jewish and the descendant of Holocaust's victims, spoke earlier this week at another event hosted by the prize organizers.
The biggest difference between Gaza and the Jewish ghettos in Nazi-occupied Europe is that Gazans, many Gazans, most Gazans, are still alive, and the world still has an opportunity to do something about it.
You can see our recent interview with Masha Gessen in Bremen at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The head of Hamas's political wing, Ismail Haniyeh, has arrived in Cairo, Egypt, for talks as hopes grow that a new deal could be reached for a ceasefire and the release of more hostages. Israel's bombardment of Gaza began 75 days ago on October 7th, just hours after Hamas's attack on Israel. Health authorities in Gaza say at least 19,600 Palestinians have been killed so far. Thousands are feared to be still trapped under the rubble. Just before this broadcast, Israel struck residential buildings in the southern city of Raqqa near the Kuwaiti Special Hospital. A reporter from Al Jazeera, Hani Mahmoud, was on the air when the attack occurred.
As we're getting into... Oh, my God. Did you hear that?
Yes, we did.
Oh, my God. That's the hospital. That's the hospital. Oh, my God. Are you guys hearing that?
Yes, we are. We are hearing that, Hani. Are you okay? Are you in a safe place to continue to talk to us?
Why, Hani Mahmoud asks the Al Jazeera reporter. Al Jazeera reports the Israeli attack destroyed a large mosque in Rafah, as well as two residential homes. Israeli drones had been seen in the sky just before the strikes. Earlier, an Israeli attack on the Jabalia refugee camp killed at least 46 Palestinians and wounded dozens. The United Nations Security Council is expected to vote on a new Gaza resolution today. The vote was postponed Tuesday after the United States voiced opposition to a draft of the resolution. On December 8th, the United States vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for ceasefire. This all comes as tension is growing in the Red Sea. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has announced the U.S. will lead a new military task force to protect ships in the Red Sea following a number of attacks by Houthi forces from Yemen. We're joined now by Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University here in New York. He's the author of several books, including his latest, The 100 Years' War on Palestine. His recent opinion piece for the Los Angeles Times is headlined, How the U.S. Has Fueled Israel's Decades-Long War on Palestinians. Professor Khalidi, I'm wondering if you can start off by just talking about the situation overall in Gaza. Your family is from the West Bank. You also have family in Gaza. And I want to just point out that I particularly talked about, named the journalist with Al Jazeera, Hani Mahmoud, because it has been so horrifying to only name journalists after they have been killed, and so many scores of them have died. Hani Mahmoud's bravery is astounding as we watch him through the Gaza Strip and today in the midst of this attack. Take it from there, Professor Khalidi.
Well, he's very fortunate that he's still alive. Over 90 journalists have been killed in Gaza we're now in the 11th week of this war. 283 healthcare workers have been killed. 135 United Nations workers have been killed. It's the highest death toll the United Nations has ever suffered in its entire history. And that's just a tip of the iceberg. You cited a number of 20,000 people earlier on, apparently having been killed. Probably the number is much higher because there are so many thousands of people buried under the rubble or missing. And we will probably not know the final death toll until many, many months from now when operations to remove the ruins of the buildings that have been destroyed are completed. The situation in Gaza is unspeakable. What we hear from my niece's family there is, I can't describe it. It's beyond belief. People are scrambling for the basic necessities of life and are sometimes not finding them. Firewood to heat water and cook, enough water for everybody to have sufficient water to drink, let alone wash. I could go on. It is unspeakable. It is intolerable. And the tragic thing about it is that this is clearly intended. Neither our government nor the Israeli government recognize the fact that what is happening there is causing this immiseration of over 2 million people. And this could easily be stopped and should be stopped. I can't understand how this country can allow this to continue. The idea that going after Hamas entails the destruction of more than half of the housing in Gaza, the idea that going after Hamas entails the wounding of 50,000 people and the killing of 20,000, it's incomprehensible to me that our governments can be so callous and can be so determined not to separate itself from Israel, as far as the basic nature of this war, which is really directed against the people of Gaza. Over 2 million people have been forced to leave their homes. This is the largest displacement in Palestinian history. The killing of 20,000 people, almost half of which are children, is unprecedented in Palestinian history. So we are talking about traumatic events that are going to scar generations to come. And this doesn't seem to be a matter of concern to our government, let alone the government of Israel.
Well, Professor Halady, we've seen massive, unprecedented demonstrations in support of the Palestinians throughout the world. The majority of governments in the General Assembly, overwhelming majority, have called for a ceasefire, yet the Security Council continues to be a roadblock, especially the United States. Can you talk about what this is doing to the legitimacy of the UN itself?
Well, I think it's harming the United Nations, but I think it's also harming the legitimacy of the United States position. It's not the Security Council that's blocking action. It's the U.S. government that's blocking action. There was one abstention, 13 votes in favor last time that a ceasefire resolution was before the Security Council. And they spent 3 days trying to get a resolution which involves not a ceasefire, but a humanitarian pause. And the United States has been obstructing that, as I've said, for 3 days. So I think this is going to harm not just the United Nations, because it's manifestly helpless in the face of this catastrophe. It's harming the United States. There is overwhelming support the world over for ending this. There is overwhelming support, sympathy the world over for the Palestinians. There is, I think the polls show very strong support, even in the United States, for ending this war. And at the very least for stopping what's going on so that humanitarian aid can get in. And the administration is clearly impervious to all of this. And I think the mainstream media, frankly, are complicit in this. Nobody knows that 4 major trade unions have come out for a ceasefire: the United Auto Workers, the nurses, the electricians, and the postal workers. The New York Times, for example, has not deigned to mention that. Well, that's a large chunk of labor. We're talking about a great deal of anger and opposition to the Biden administration's policy among wide swaths of the American people. And they just plow on as if none of this mattered. I find it very hard to explain, frankly.
I wanted to ask you about, there have been numerous media reports of attacks on U.S. troops in Syria and Iraq that are threatening to expand the conflict beyond just the occupied territories in Gaza. But what the heck are U.S. troops still doing in those two countries? Has Congress authorized their presence there? Do the governments of those countries even want them there?
Well, the government of Syria, the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, certainly doesn't want them there. And the pretext for their being in Syria is against the Islamic State. I don't think there is any authorization for their being there. The troops that are in Iraq are supposedly engaged in training the Iraqi army, but there's a great deal of opposition in Iraq, even though the Iraqi government has accepted their presence there. There's a great deal of opposition in the Iraqi parliament to the presence of U.S. forces in Iraq. And I think what we're seeing are attacks, whether from Yemen on shipping or firing missiles at Israel, or attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq or in Syria, which are a response to what Israel is doing in Gaza. And the same is true, obviously, of the fighting that's going on between Hezbollah and the Israeli army along Israel's northern frontiers. And the fear is that this could possibly expand, that this could become a regional war. So far, we're now in the 11th week of this war, since the 7th of October. And so far, that fear has been, or that possibility has been contained. But it is always there. And it would lead to, I think, possibly terrible consequences were the war to expand beyond its already quite horrific level in Gaza, and were that to spark a further increase of fighting along the Lebanese border, in Syria, Iraq, or out of Yemen.
Can you talk about also what's happening in the Red Sea? You have a dozen corporations who say they won't ship their goods through the Red Sea. You have U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announcing a 10-nation coalition to protect trading interests there, including Bahrain, Canada, France, Italy, the U.K., the Seychelles, Houthi officials saying that their drone and missile attacks will continue as long as Israel bombards Gaza.
There is enormous anger in the Arab world about what is happening in Gaza. Things that Americans don't see or don't see enough of, the scenes of what is actually happening in Gaza, are being watched all over the Arab world and across much of the world. And the anger that people have and their frustration at the unwillingness of their governments to do more to try and stop this is palpable. In Saudi Arabia, people can't demonstrate. In some countries, they can demonstrate. But you talk to anybody in any of these countries, and public opinion is boiling. And the passivity of Arab governments in the face of this, their unwillingness to actually take action, I think is contrasts with Hezbollah, militias in Iraq and Syria, and the Houthis in Yemen actually engaging militarily. In doing something, and I think it is really time for countries that want to have a ceasefire to begin to group together, whether Arab countries or European countries or countries in the global south, to group together and say there will be XYZ sanctions if this doesn't stop. At the very least, if sufficient humanitarian aid, if sufficient field hospitals, if sufficient water and food and so forth are not allowed into Gaza, this and this and this will be done to Israel, which is responsible. I think that there are countries that could do this, including Arab countries. Jordan has recalled its ambassador. Well, that's not going to affect Israel very much. But stopping the transportation of food from the Gulf to Israel, apparently the Emiratis are shipping food to Israel, would actually affect Israel. Doing things that threaten diplomatic relations would have an impact. Now, that in and of itself is not enough, but I think a lot more has to be done. The United Nations, as we can see, is paralyzed by the UN veto, by the U.S., I should say, veto. The General Assembly has done what it could, 153-10. You can't have a more lopsided vote than that. I think more has to be done to bring home to people in Washington in particular that this is unacceptable and actually unsustainable. That the possibility of this overflowing into a regional conflagration, which is always there, is only part of the damage that is being done. Whole generations are being brought up angry at the United States, enraged at Israel, all over the region. And Israel is going to have to deal with this for decades to come. The United States is going to have to deal with this for decades to come. We are seen as complicit. These are American artillery shells, American bombs, American rockets, American planes, American helicopters, American artillery that are being used in this war. 20,000 people have been killed mainly with American weapons, mostly civilians in Gaza. And people are not going to forget that, unfortunately. And I don't see a sense of the impact of this in Washington. I really think they live in some kind of a bubble, in some kind of a vacuum, in some kind of a fact-free space where they don't seem to understand the impact of all of this. What they're thinking and why they're thinking that is actually beyond me, as I've said.
I want to ask you, Rashid Khalidi, about the Hamas leader, Ismail Haniyeh, in Egypt to discuss a possible new truce. The Wall Street Journal reporting Hamas is also in discussions with Palestinian rivals like Fatah about a possible joint scenario for ruling the West Bank and Gaza afterwards. Of course, Netanyahu is completely against this. If you can talk about the discussion of the hostage negotiations, where we've seen reports of possibly Marwan Barghouti, and if you can explain his significance being released for a number of Israeli soldiers released. Talk about all of this that's going on right now so people can understand what's next.
Well, that's a large number of questions. I think the first thing, the hostage issue. There has been a huge problem around the hostages, because what Hamas has been demanding up until now is essentially an all-for-all exchange. All of the prisoners and hostages, I mean, there's some of the hostages are military, and many of them are civilians. And what they've been saying, apparently, from what we can tell from press reports, is that if you want all of the hostages, you're going to have to release all of the prisoners. And that is one possibility, I think unlikely. And one of the prisoners who could therefore be released is Marwan Barghouti, who's a senior Fatah leader who was convicted of multiple murders by an Israeli military court that he never recognized, and who might well